gender ideology, what it does is it tells anyone that isn't on the far left masculine pole and the far right feminine pole has to, can't be a boy or a girl.
The language I've often heard, and I'm sure you have too, of mental health providers or doctors that will say to parents, do you want a dead daughter or a live son?
Anyone who knows anything about like child or adolescent psychology is not going to be sort of like in the business of like crystallizing an identity early in development.
James Lindsay, as one of the co-authors of The Queering of the American Child, and just talking about, in that book, he writes about this idea of queering from their own words, the mothers and fathers of queer theory, that it's not about making someone gay or not. It's about the dismantling and the tearing down of all things heteronormative. And it's really more about kind of chaos and anarchy than anything else.
The kind of culture at large always telling you, like, this policy in this state that just says, hey, this medical practice doesn't work for this particular treatment is inherently discriminatory and they want to erase you from the face of the earth. Obviously, to a population that's really sensitive to this kind of perceived rejection, this kind of messaging also, I think, amplifies a lot of this catastrophic thinking that some people, I think, are already inclined to do.
You get these people that are down this road, double mastectomies or other medical interventions that have gone on, and eventually realizing, I don't know that I'm ever going to get to where I thought I could be, but I can never go back to who I once was either.
If that's the case, if this is non-pathological and the distress is not inherent to this way of being, then how can this also be simultaneously life-saving or medically necessary care?
Truth is like a lion. You don't need to defend it. You just need to let it loose.
Welcome to the Love and Truth Network podcast, your guide for hope and healing in a hurting world searching for truth. Here we explore God's extraordinary design for biblical sexuality, identity, and authentic community. You'll be impacted by incredible stories of transformation, practical wisdom from pastors and counselors, and the power of God's grace that changes lives.
Hey, everybody, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Love and Truth Network podcast. We're glad that you're here today, and I have somebody who's with me. I met not that long ago in a panel discussion that was being put on. I was reached out to by a group, Concepts of Truth International, and they're connected with the United Nations and working to have an influence there in some of the committees and some of the presentations that are there. So on the Commission for Social Development, this particular group was doing something on the so-called, the mental health harms of so-called gender-affirming care for children, pediatric gender-affirming care. And in that panel discussion, I videotaped a session and I interviewed Laura Perry Smaltz for that particular session. And Joseph Figliolia was actually there live with some others who were presenting on that. And it's the first experience I had of getting to know him. And I thought, wow, I would love for you all to be able to hear his wisdom on this. And to be right up front, Joseph is not a Christian. He's not a believer. And usually I'm interviewing people who are speaking from that framework. But frankly, I love the fact that Joseph is bringing a completely different framework to this discussion. I'm excited for you to hear about this, but he's not bringing this from a biblical Christian worldview perspective. He's bringing simply science, research, data to talk about these issues of gender identity and particularly with regard to surgeries of minors and those kinds of things, and how and Joseph, feel free to push back if I misrepresent anything, but how many of our professional organizations that we look to, the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and many others have really been, from my perspective, have been taken captive by an ideology-first perspective that in many ways puts this ideology in front of genuine science. And then there's like this shoehorning effect of trying to make science fit with an ideology that doesn't even ultimately make sense. So, again, Joseph, if I've misrepresented you there, feel free to clarify any of that. But thanks for coming on our program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And for the record, I may not be a true believer, but I'm interested in theology and kind of religious metaphysics in general. So
That's great. That's great. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're speaking from the perspective that you are. So in opening up the conversation, the discussion, you know, I've shared a little bit for myself, and I mentioned it, I think, even in the video that I sent over to for the purpose of this panel discussion before the United Nations committee. And one of the things I talked about is when I was a teen, an early teen, there was a good maybe year and a half, 2 years where, and I think even prior to that, I had some of these feelings, but I just felt like it didn't make sense that I was even in this body. Like somehow everything about me seemed to relate better to girls. It seemed to, I didn't feel comfortable with boys, or I was oftentimes bullied and picked on, and it didn't fit in with most boys. There was a very narrow caricature of what it looked like to be a boy or a girl in many ways. And so I certainly experienced that. And for a good year and a half, maybe two, I distinctly felt like this is all wrong. If I could go back, if I could somehow have been made a girl, God must have screwed something up. And so that was something that I wrestled with. Of course, I never told anybody about that kind of thing, but even doing some cross-dressing in my bedroom away from everybody, those kinds of things, definitely engaged in some of that. And I look back on that now and I think, oh, there was profound confusion going on in my mind about who I was and what it meant to be a boy. And of course that was being reinforced by a lot of things out here coming at me. But when I think about that, I think about friends like Chloe Cole and, you know, many others I've actually interviewed, Ted Haley and many others on this podcast, the way that culture right now, and I feel like the brakes have been tapped a little bit, but I feel like the way that we've been moving is this creating this idea of fluidity around gender, and this idea that there's all kinds of different genders. And it's already hard being a kid moving into adulthood, going through puberty and that entire process. That is not easy at all for a lot of different reasons. But now we live in a culture that is removing even the most basic scientific boundaries of, well, maybe you're not even a girl, maybe you're not even a boy. And we're just widening these opportunities for kids to have all kinds of confusion, and to believe that if I go through social transition, chemical transition, and maybe a surgical transition, that it's going to solve all of these feelings of unrest and disturbance. And so I think it's a really awful thing that we're setting children up for in general. But I would just love for you to comment either on what I'm sharing there, or just kind of launch our audience and understanding more about who you are and how you got interested even in these topics.
Well, I would say one thing, I would say that what you're getting at too is, I think, the evolution of, I know you've talked about this before, but the kind of competing ways that we can kind of think about gender distress or sex distress. And then you have like historically this like gender dysphoria paradigm, right? And then you have what some people would call the gender diversity paradigm, or WPATH uses the language of gender incongruence. And so what's going on here is essentially, in the name of destigmatizing and depathologizing sex distress, they created a new category that is essentially only defined in relation to stereotypes, but then it then actually removes distress as the key feature. So now the only thing that makes you transgender per se is that identity claim, right? The distress is no longer key, but then you have this tension or paradox where, if that's the case, if this is non-pathological and the distress is not inherent to this way of being, then how can this also be simultaneously life-saving or medically necessary care? And that's kind of a tension I've been fascinated by since I started working on this. And I actually just wrote an article for The Dispatch on WPATH's standards of care, and I focus in on this point because I think it gets at the tension between doing kind of robust psychological assessment and differential diagnosis and then affirming the identity. Because if the claim is that these identities are immutable and natural, and there's people are generally right about, they know who they are, so to speak, as the language activists say, is, you know, kids, these trans kids mm-hmm. know who they are. If that's the case, then there's a lot less incentive to do this kind of other psychological screening, because in the end you're thinking, okay, they like these conditions are not causally driving their experience, so they're secondary. And then so the idea is that you can kind of just engage in affirming interventions, and then the psychological comorbidities will kind of melt away by addressing the gender first and foremost. Of course, data shows that generally speaking, psychiatric utilization is still pretty high even after affirming care interventions or sex reassignment. So that's kind of an interesting point that it is, as far as we know, and there's limited data on this, but that these procedures don't kind of provide that cure-all that a lot of people think they do.
Yes, which in the end, if you're expecting this to be some kind of cure-all, and I remember there's a gal on social media that has recorded a few different takes, I mean, maybe many now over the years, and she talked about how for her, the goalpost kept moving. She would establish something that felt like, I'm going to become a man or more of a man if I do this. And the idea of it and the moving toward it was very, was something that heightened her emotions. And it was kind of euphoric for a while. But as she moved closer to it, and then as she achieved it, the goalpost moved again. And every time it would happen. And she just talked about that as being a pretty common experience.
The writing of Sarah Mittermeier. She goes by, she used to write under a pen name, Eliza Mongreen. But she writes about sort of online trans communities. And she's written about this phenomena before, where in some cases you actually have people that are not dysphoric to start. They start with trans identification and then they become dysphoric, basically through this process where they start things that they wouldn't have fixated on previously now become increasingly psychologically salient. And so then you're trying, and then it's like, okay, now it's like, but my hands aren't masculine or feminine enough, or I have hair where I don't. It just becomes like, as soon as you reconcile yourself with one part of your physical self, it's like you're now dissatisfied with another part of your physical self. And so it actually kind of, I think people have described it online as almost like transgender OCD is how people phrase it, where they become like very preoccupied with their secondary sex characteristics. And then I think there's always this burden of, which I think is really sad and I imagine is very stressful, of just constantly feeling like, do I pass? How are people reading me? Am I perceived the way I want to be perceived? Or, and then worrying about like misgendering or like just wanting to be seen a certain way, and then constantly kind of doubting whether you're actually seen that way, I think is just puts a tremendous amount of like psychological stress on a group of people that I think are already pretty stressed out, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point. And what really grieves me, the more I think about this and with some of the friends that I have that are detransitioners, is, again, they believed that, and I can understand how a young person could feel like, I have all this pain, all this junk, all this stuff going on inside of me. I don't even know what it's all connected to. Sometimes it's connected to abuse situations or rejection, abandonment, a variety of things, but there's all this emotional stuff that's going on within them. And some of it is very connected to very real things. Some of it, you know, our perception feels like everything to the individual, to me, to you. Our perception feels true. And so when we perceive these things and then they're reinforced in society as being bedrock truth, and a young person starts to think that if I just go through with this process, it's all going to be better. It's a concrete way of resolving these issues. And they start down this pathway through social transition, and then maybe very shortly chemical transition of some kind or another, whether that's puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and those things alone, just the cross-sex hormones and puberty blockers have major side effects, and which you could speak to, I'm sure. But then surgery, and you get these people that are down this road, double mastectomies or other medical interventions that have gone on, and eventually realizing, I don't know that I'm ever going to get to where I thought I could be, but I can never go back to who I once was either. At least in terms of what I've, you know, what I've done or what I've allowed other people to do to me. And I just think that is such a horrific place to lead people to. it just to me makes so much more sense that you would deal with the dysphoria or the issues that are going on within the mental health issue within that person, maybe issues, and bring them to a place of congruence with their bodies, because they can never become the other gender. That's a pipe dream.
Yeah, you're raising a lot of interesting points. And I think part of that, I've noticed something where there's a lot of sort of ideological assumptions built into even like the clinical framing of this kind of problem. Like one thing that often comes up frequently is this concept of minority stress theory. I don't know if you're familiar. It's a model that basically just tries to explain why there are potentially elevated rates of psychiatric issues among minority populations. And there's a sort of a version of this that is trans specific. And the idea is basically like, in order the truth is that there are elevated rates of psychiatric issues in this population. So to explain it, they're like, sure, what's going on here? In this depathologized gender incongruence, gender diversity paradigm, you can't kind of have, there's a tension here being like, this is not pathological, but then like, why are they suffering? What's going on here? So the explanation that's often posited is that it's due to societal stigma, discrimination, prejudice, etc., which ignores that for a lot of this population, their trans identity, they were suffering with psychiatric issues before they were trans identified in a lot of cases. And I think you talked about how powerful perception is. And I've written about this before, because I think that what's going on here is partly a perceptual issue fueled by the kind of affective and cognitive processes often associated with mental health issues, including like rejection sensitivity, which you're hypersensitive to perceived rejection, abandonment, and this tends to be correlated with a lot of psychiatric issues. But trans-identified people and kids often have, we've seen this in some data, often have real experiences of ostracization or bullying as kids, but not even related to gender identity. These are kids that tend to have social and peer challenges even prior to that. And so I think what you're getting is you have these kind of perceptual problems, which are then fueled by the kind of culture at large always telling you like, this policy in this state that just says, hey, this medical practice doesn't work for this particular treatment is inherently discriminatory, and they want to erase you from the face of the earth. Obviously, to a population that's really sensitive to this kind of perceived rejection, this kind of messaging also, I think, amplifies a lot of this catastrophic thinking that some people, I think, are already inclined to do. Mm-hmm. At least that's something I've thought quite a bit about. So,
yeah, I agree, and I think also just in the when you're talking there, Joseph, you bring up a point in my mind about the various bans that have been placed on mental health counseling for minors. And in Canada, of course, there's a complete ban on whether you're a minor or an adult. You know, counselors, really no one is allowed to walk with somebody if they come to a pastor or they come to a mental health counselor and say, you know, I'm experiencing gender dysphoria and I'm not comfortable with trying to become the other sex. I don't believe that's possible, or it doesn't align with my spiritual beliefs or whatever. And yet I'm experiencing these things. And I'm wondering, would you pray with me? Would you help me from a mental health perspective to a licensed counselor or whatever? It is illegal in Canada to do that for anyone, whether it's a minor or an adult.
Alberta might be the one exception as far as I know. But yeah, Canada is pretty all in on a lot of this.
Okay. But here we have in our country, many states, and this is actually a question now before the Supreme Court, right? There are many states that have banned therapy for minors. And here's my point in saying that. Actually, I'd love your comments on this. It's interesting how so much of this is cast as the compassionate approach. It's cast as, oh, we're going to make anything but so-called gender-affirming care, whether that's surgical chemical or mental health, we're going to make all of that illegal. And we're just going to affirm what you believe to be true about yourself or what you want to be true about yourself. And somehow, and it's easy to understand how that's cast as compassionate. But when you look at all these countless numbers of detransitioners that are now like, what in the world did I do to myself? Why was this even something I could do to myself? At a certain age, the ability to make informed consent is impossible at a certain age. And so, you know, what in the world have we done? And I think that I'd just love your thoughts on that perspective of how do we get into the kind of the mess that we're in right now? And what are some pathways forward, I guess, in terms of dialing this back and helping people really process through the gender dysphoria or the other mental health issues that are going on?
I mean, my intuition would be that adopting a treatment that has a more favorable risk-benefit profile, even though there's, you know, it's true that there's not great high-quality evidence, for example, about psychotherapy for the treatment of gender distress, but psychotherapy has a much more favorable risk-benefit profile. There's no irreversible intervention here. And psychotherapy historically is good at treating a lot of the comorbid mental health conditions that are often associated with sex distress.
Mm-hmm.
But to your other point, I think that the main problem with the affirmation-only approach is that it's not developmentally sound, and it tips the scales in favor of a particular outcome when psychologists are, in theories, right, supposed to be not tipping the scales in either direction. And it's not a very, it's
right,
not a very
self-determination.
And it's not a very developmentally sound approach to treat, like, anyone who knows anything about like child or adolescent psychology, for example, is not going to be sort of like in the business of like crystallizing an identity early in development. And then you get into the issue with historically how a lot of trans identified youth are same sex attracted. But then you get into this issue of like, is affirmation therapy actually, people have made this point before, is this actually ironically another form of gay conversion therapy, which is kind of like an interesting way to rethink it, because this is framed as the compassionate approach, but you could actually argue that this is kind of in the name of being compassionate, they're skipping steps to the point where they're actually harming a very vulnerable population that they purport to care about. And so I think it's more about not being developmentally sound or informed and being kind of cavalier with the risks.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to your point about, should we talk a little bit more about how we got here medically, how our medical associations?
Yes, please.
So for listeners, I'm sure a lot of people here are probably familiar with the idea that, generally speaking, the U.S. medical establishment is pretty all in on gender affirming care for the most part. There's often a common refrain that all major medical associations endorse these practices. And that's generally speaking true, especially until recently. But what the average person probably may not know is that in a lot of ways, this consensus was both artificially constructed and also not based on the highest quality evidence in what's known as evidence-based medicine, which is kind of a field that evaluates the quality of evidence available and then tries to make recommendations that have the most, you know, favorable risk-benefit ratios after kind of assessing what do we actually know about the interventions. So a couple of, and you know what, it's worth saying about this too, the original Dutch protocol that pioneered gender medicine has the two studies that came out of the Netherlands. The Dutch protocol has never been replicated. The UK tried to replicate this and they were not able to do it. The study itself had a lot of methodological issues. There's a great article I recommend people read called The Myth of Reliable Research in Pediatric Gender Medicine that goes over a lot of these controversies and just goes over the problems with why these studies weren't, you know, robust from an evidence standpoint from the get-go. And actually, pediatric medical interventions were in part conceptualized because adults had such poor psychological outcomes. So the idea was if we intervene earlier, maybe the outcomes will be better based on the assumption that well-being is all kind of determined based on how well your appearance and your gender identity match, this idea of appearance congruence, it's called. However, the actual practice was done in what's called an innovative practice framework, which is more experimental and is not essentially is for a small population. It was not meant to be scaled up without these kind of robust clinical trials or whatever that were essentially never done. And then this practice was kind of scaled up around the world, despite quite a small sample. But then going back to the consensus in the United States, the U.S. Endocrine Society, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, I think, are the big three organizations that kind of came out endorsing these practices. And what many people may not realize is that these position statements put out by these organizations or clinical practice guidelines in some cases are often not actually looking at the evidence directly or weighing the strength of the evidence in the way that like a European style evidence review in countries like the UK, Sweden, and Finland have done, where the healthcare bodies there actually commissioned evidence reviews, looked at the overall risk-benefit ratio and said, hey, you know what? The evidence for harms is fairly considerable and the evidence for benefits is weak. So based on that kind of risk-benefit calculus, more cautious approaches should be the default approach. And again, these are based on evidence reviews. In the United States, the U.S. Endocrine Society's guidelines endorsing pediatric gender medicine were based on studies of adults, not based on studies of children. The American Academy of Pediatrics position statement famously was written by a single pediatrician, Dr. Jason Rafferty, and it was also not based on evidence reviews. And then WPATH most famously commissioned evidence reviews by researchers at Johns Hopkins and then actually suppressed the evidence reviews because they, like all the other systematic reviews that have been done in this area, only found low certainty evidence. And so we know that from litigation in the case of Boe v. Marshall in Alabama. So this came out through discovery. And I think that the average person kind of assumes that medical associations are only endorsing practices based on the highest quality science. And oftentimes when these organizations say things like the practice is evidence-based, they're not using evidence-based in this sense of evidence-based medicine. They're using it in this more kind of casual sense of like it's been part of a research study, regardless of whether or not that particular study is reliable or high quality.
Okay. Wow. So what you're saying there with WPATH, for example, that they had commissioned research, but then suppressed the results because it didn't prove to be as favorable as they were looking for it to be to bolster their perspective or their ideology. Is that a fair?
That's correct. And Jesse, the journalist Jesse Single, actually wrote about this for The Economist a few years ago. Okay. And that story has been out there for, you know, years. And it's kind of like one of those things that if you follow this topic, you're aware of it. If you don't follow it super closely, it may not be something you're aware of. But I mean, this is a very important kind of story, right? About the nature of evidence and kind of like how we know things. And when I think it shows, you know, the kind of failure of the medical establishment to kind of act in the best interest of the public and also kind of is disingenuous in the way that they frame the evidence for the public.
Okay. Well, when you're talking about risk-benefit ratios, you mentioned that a few times, and what comes to mind, and that makes a lot of sense when that's based on actual science and outcomes. But when I think about that idea of of risk-benefit ratio in terms of the language I've often heard, and I'm sure you have too, of mental health providers or doctors that will say to parents, do you want a dead daughter or a live son? Do you want a dead son or a live daughter? I mean, to that parent, they're lighting their hair on fire thinking, oh my gosh. I mean, so if the result is you as the professional are saying, this is the likely outcome, death of my child, and so that's a risk I'm not willing to take, and so I'll do anything to avoid that. And so, yes, let's go down this road that you're recommending. I mean, that just seems unbelievably egregious to me. And I would love if there's any data that you're aware of, Joseph, around the fallacy. Of course, there are those who have committed suicide that are dealing with gender dysphoria and these kinds of things. But is that statement? Is that the kind of thing that counselors and medical personnel should be putting out to parents as if those are the only two alternatives?
No, and I think this has been a kind of a point of a talking point and a huge debate about the suicide claim, because it's often used as kind of it's often kind of something that hangs over parents' heads when they're making yes. decisions for their kids. And I mean, there's no good evidence that, not receiving affirming care leads to suicide. There are elevated rates of suicidality associated with trans identities and gender dysphoria, which is separate than completed suicide. So suicidality is suicidal ideation or thinking about suicide. My understanding of this, generally speaking, is that this is often more associated with the comorbidities that often plague this population. So there was a study from the Netherlands that looked at all-cause suicide mortality, and they found that when you actually control for these comorbidities, they're what predict suicide outcomes, not gender dysphoria. And there's often, it's often framed that there's going to be a suicide epidemic if we stop kids from medically transitioning. But again, there's no good evidence that that's the case. And most of the time, yeah. this conflates suicide and suicidality. And famously, during Scarmetti oral arguments, Chase Strangio, the lawyer representing the ACLU, conceded that completed suicides are rare in this population. And that, kind of retreated to the suicidality instead of the suicide argument. So I think that's a huge point of, it's a huge misunderstanding in this area. And I think also, so oftentimes the advice is often, we need to be better at addressing psychiatric comorbidities in this population to prevent suicidality and suicide, as opposed to, rendering affirming care practices. Your other point, though, I think gets at, you use the word egregious, which I think is appropriate because you have this incredibly manipulative tactic from an informed consent standpoint, right? And this actually was a talking point in are you familiar with the Fox Varian detransitioner case from New York?
Yeah.
Yes. This was a talking point in her case as well, where apparently her psychologist. And there was a lot of just egregious violations of the standard of care in this case. But the psychologist told the mom allegedly that her daughter would kill herself if she wouldn't transition. And of course, that's not true. And so, from an informed consent standpoint, it's even more problematic, because you're making a decision under false pretenses and under false information. Most people point out simply the fact that based on their immaturity, minors can't cognitively, even though they're assenting, because parents are the key decision makers for gender medicine, even though they're assenting, there's still, there's a larger issue of when the information being shared with families isn't accurate. That's also an informed consent problem, right? Because if you're making yes. these decisions under duress, thinking that your child is going to kill themselves if they're not given these interventions, that's an incredibly manipulative tactic to use, especially if and I'm sure a lot of those physicians probably believe what they're told. Like that talking point has been out there so much that I and it's repeated by civil rights organizations, yes, medical associations. So I don't blame, you know, parents for hearing that and thinking that there's merit to the claim, but it's on the medical providers who are supposed to be the experts on these issues, I think, to make sure that what they're, the information they're sharing is true.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned a few times the phrase comorbidity. And for those who might not know what that is, we're just talking about comorbidity in mental health is just talking about the issue of multiple mental health struggles. It could be two, three or more. And in that those, in other words, those within the trans-identified population, not all, but a large percentage are dealing with a comorbid issue of other kinds of mental health issues, whether that's whether that could be bipolar or a variety of different, it could be anything, OCD or whatever. But also within that population, and this isn't, wouldn't fall in class, be classified, I don't think, under comorbidity, but many times, Joseph, isn't it true that within the those that identify as transgender, that there's a larger than average population on the spectrum within that?
Yeah, I would say the numbers are differ depending on the study, but I would say, I've seen anywhere from like a third to half of samples at times have have neurodevelopmental issues. Mm-hmm. There's lots of thoughts about kind of what's going on there. Some people will, I mean, what I personally find most convincing is that people that are on the spectrum are tend to be more kind of like cognitively rigid in certain ways. And so mm-hmm. they're more, they tend to kind of the stereotypical thinking kind of shapes their self-understanding in more ways because they're like, oh, if a boy is like X and I'm like Y, then I can't be a boy, yes, right? And so there's this sense of like, I think that it's the black and people have attributed it to kind of cognitive inflexibility and kind of black and white thinking, mm-hmm. which is an interesting way to think about it. It's hard to know exactly what's going on there. You know, the trans activist community would frame it as just kind of like, there's nothing to see here. There's just, it's totally, there's no connection, but obviously there's something going on there. And I think people that are more, and this is kind of the problem with the ideology based framing is that all these kind of nuances, like, wouldn't you want to know about like why this developmentally unique population happens to identify with this category, right? And I think to me, it's no coincidence that this happens when you're moving towards the gender incongruence, gender diversity paradigm that's not primarily distress-based, but is more about like defining men and women in relation to sex stereotypes, because then it causes people like this to then reassess their self-understanding in light of the stereotypes, right? And if you're more cognitively rigid, then that's more likely to influence you. Someone else who's just like not like that would be like, I don't care if it says that boys have to like blue, like that's silly. Whatever. But someone else is like, oh, that's interesting. I must not be a boy then if I like yellow, you know? So that's my theory. I don't actually know exactly what's going on there, but.
Well, I would love for you to talk about the idea of stereotypes a little bit more, because it seems to me when I was growing up, it seems like those that were considered to be, I grew up in a very kind of legalistic Christian background. And so the rigidity around that was pretty difficult and pretty challenging. But I used to see that those in the secular world, those that maybe in the non-Christian faith, or maybe there were some in Christian faith, but yet they seemed to be far less rigid about, you know, everything's being black and white. But it seems to me that the groups that I kind of grew up around that were less rigid are now even more so rigid around the stereotype issue. Like people are being pigeonholed as, oh, if you act this way, if you talk this way, if you express yourself this way, then you're gay, you're trans, you're this, you're that. And there seems to be no room or no space whatsoever, even from a in some cases, from a Christian worldview perspective, that God created masculinity and femininity as very distinct things, but with a range of what that can look like in terms of how we live that out, how our personality affects our masculinity or femininity, and a lot of other things, and that can affect kind of the range and the way that we live that out. And so, yes, stereotypes are understandable in that the norm or the greater percent of the population may function this way or that way. But to be so rigid that if you don't do that, that you somehow fall outside of that and you're now some subset of masculinity or some subset of femininity, I think it's egregious. I think it's unbiblical and also unscientific from that perspective. But would you speak a little bit more about what you've seen from the stereotype perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I would just start by saying that if you're not going to define trans or in relation to, you know, the distress over your secondary sex characteristics, then you have to define in relation to something else. And so the American Psychological Association, for example, defines, I've cited this a million times because I found it so fascinating. They define transgender as an umbrella term that refers to anyone that the language is like dresses, behaves, or expresses themselves in ways that are non-stereotypical for their sex. So just think about that for a second. Like,
that's the majority of us, I feel like, in some way.
Yeah,
or another.
And so my issue with that framing, and this is why I dislike the term non-binary so much, because like it implies that anyone who has like an integrated personality with like masculine and feminine traits can't be within the sex binary, that they have to transcend it, that you're like a unicorn. Mm-hmm. Which is insane, because the majority of the population, as you said, is not rigidly, in terms of personality traits, hyper-masculine or hyper-feminine. Essentially, gender ideology, what it does is it tells anyone that isn't on the far left masculine pole and the far right feminine pole can't be a boy or a girl.
Yep.
And then that means that, and then people that don't fit into those boxes think I'm either a different sex or I'm non-binary. Like it's crazy to me how certain, like, women will just be like, yeah, like, I like some masculine things. I can't be a girl. Or, like, they feel like they can't be women if they're not hyper-feminine. And this is, I think, bad for everyone. It's bad for men. It's bad for women. And then, of course, you have the issue that then the entire field then essentially medicalizes gender nonconformity, right? Because if now you're basing treatments off gender identity and how you understand your gender, and you're not making it conditional on gender dysphoria or sex distress, then essentially we're just like medicalizing people that don't conform to sex stereotypes, yes. Which like I'm deeply uncomfortable with personally. And I think a lot of people are deeply uncomfortable with. And I think framing it this way is, I think, one of the ways that I found, not that I think this is a public health issue and not a left and right political issue, but this kind of argument seems to be very, it kind of breaks the minds of people on the left, because they're not often thinking about it from this vantage point. And when they realize that their intellectual project kind of reinforces these sex stereotypes, I think they kind of are like, oh no, that's bad.
Well, I find all that to be very fascinating, of how things have kind of shifted with regard to stereotypes and how people have unconsciously moved toward reinforcing very rigid stereotypes when originally and at a core level, like, they're actually against that. But that's always true when, you know, I oftentimes as a Christian, I can't stand the idea of her truth, his truth, my truth, your truth. It's like there is one thing that's true, and we can live that. We can either reject that, live it. I mean, live it out any way you want to. But if there is a God, then all truth is God's truth, whether that's found in the atheist or the agnostic or the Christian. But there is one truth, and so to come back to a place of being able to say, yes, these things are factual. They're not up for debate. I mean, in terms of male and female. Like, those are the only genders, those are the only sexes. And we can't, we're not something in between. Yes, there's the very, very rare instance of intersexed, but that is a whole, that's something that is actually measurable, that can be seen. Go ahead and speak to that,
Joseph. I was going to say that there's often a tendency, I think it's a strategic decision, I think, on the point of activists to often conflate intersex conditions with gender, because they want you to think about them in the same way. But they're obviously, my self-belief about whether I'm a man or a woman has nothing to do with intersex status. Like, they're just different. They're just different things. But they want you to think about trans people as like psychologically intersex, if you will. Like, as like, that's kind of the, and then they'll get into statistics about how prevalent intersex is, and they're often inflated, where it'll say like intersex is like 2.5% of the population or something like that, which is like not true actually, but that number gets thrown out a lot to kind of then, you know, make people think this is actually like dramatically more common than it actually is.
Joseph, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, to come back to a little bit of our earlier conversation, is that I've read that people who have gone through some kind of transgender surgery are actually, after surgery, are much higher, have a much higher rate of committing suicide, not just suicidal ideation, than the average population. So you're in the midst of all this, and you see the research. What are your thoughts? Is that an accurate statement or not?
So there's one, I believe it's a Polish study. I was trying to look up there's not a lot of great data on longitudinal outcomes in this population, but there is, I believe, I think it's a Polish study. The author, it's like DeJenny or something like that. It's DJENE. There's a paper that purports to show that adults that have undergone sex reassignment, and I don't want to get this wrong because I don't have the paper in front of me, but I believe it's people that have actually gone through full medicalization have, at least in, you know, this limited sample, have worse psychological outcomes than people, which then raises the question. I mean, it's not a controlled study, so it's kind of like we're left trying to figure out why. Like, are maybe these people could be, they might have had the worst dysphoria in the first place. If you're going to go through with medical, like genital bottom surgery, presumably you're more motivated than someone who's just likes to, you know, wear a cross-dress or go by neo pronouns or whatever. It's that's very different kind of way of dealing with it than like committing to the full slate of physical interventions. But there is, you know, there is a study, at least one pretty famous one that suggests that, like, scientific data is often, you know, compared with like anecdotal clinical data, like what patients report. And then you get into this issue where like, doctors will be like, but patients say that they like it and it makes them happy, which is like, and maybe they express that, but that's not like a substitute for kind of like robust scientific evidence, right? I mean,
like, and certainly longitudinal, right? That's the other thing too, is anybody can go through a surgery or something else and have an immediate outcome that feels like, oh, I've achieved my goal. But I think that anything that's been looked at has been very, very short term. And then for those that don't stay in a longitudinal study, I don't know that there's even been follow-up as to what happened to them, you know? So, as you said, there aren't good studies out there that show over a long period of time, what are the outcomes? Has there been improvement in regard to mental health? Are there higher suicide rates in that population?
Yeah, I found this study. I'm looking at the conclusion, just for our listeners.
Yeah.
The conclusions for this study were: persons with transsexualism after sex reassignment have considerably higher risk for mortality, suicidal behavior, and psychiatric morbidity than the general population. Our findings suggest that sex reassignment, although alleviating gender dysphoria, may not suffice as treatment for transsexualism and should inspire improved psychiatric and somatic care after sex reassignment for this patient group. This is one, it's one study. Wow. This was a population-based matched cohort study in Sweden. Sorry, it wasn't Poland. Between 1973 and 2003.
Okay. Wow. Well, Joseph, as we're wrapping up here, one of the things I wanted to also ask you about, and I have no idea what your perspective is on this, but I don't feel like I'm approaching this even from a necessarily like a Christian lens or religious lens, but I talk to people who Christian, non-Christian, whatever, who would hold the same basic views that you and I would, I think, on this topic and be very concerned about it, be very much against children being, operated on and put on this conveyor belt toward a false ideology, someone that they can never become. But at the same time, they're also trying to be kind in the social space. So whether it's on social media or maybe in other spaces, maybe it's an email, whatever, they're actually choosing, again, as a way of trying to be kind and inclusive, they themselves know that they're female or male, and there's no opportunity to become the other, nor do they want to, but they put their pronouns in that align with their biology, or they refer to themselves as even cisgender. And when I'm talking with these folks, it's always people that have a high level of compassion. They're very merciful. Again, they want to be really inclusive. But when I see this, I'm like, actually, you're not doing anyone any favors by putting this out there and associating it with your name, because we're actually like there. I used to use the phrase all the time. I mean, for quite a while, because of what was going on in culture, I would say biological man, biological woman. Well, I've stopped saying that altogether because there's no such thing other than a biological man or a woman. So it's simply a man or a woman. I'm not going to use the word biological because that implies there's some other kind.
Sure.
And so I think when we assign ourselves pronouns that align with our biology, thinking, well, what's wrong with that? Or we refer to ourselves as cisgender, we're buying into the language and the makeup of something that's so much bigger. Like it's a societal, in many ways, a push globally even to go back to what you and I were talking about, James Lindsay, as one of the co-authors of The Queering of the American Child, and just talking about in that book, he writes about this idea of queering from their own words, the mothers and fathers of queer theory, that it's not about making someone gay or not. It's about the dismantling and the tearing down of all things heteronormative. And it's really more about kind of chaos and anarchy than anything else. And I just think that when we are trying to be merciful and kind, that's a very good motivation, but we need to have some wisdom about being a part of a larger movement to shift public opinion and perspective around these things that are so critical, like gender and sex.
I mean, I think what you're getting at is the way that like language shapes reality in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree. What you're getting at is like, it might feel like neutral or kind to use language like cisgender, but then you're reproducing the kind of you're operating within the concepts and worldview that you like may not agree with. You're basically like reproducing it. And the problem I think is when everyone kind of uses, it's like this, like, I forgot the name of George Orwell has like a language on.
Oh yeah, it becomes the new normal.
An essay on political language, and I think what you have with gender stuff is I think very similar, where the language shapes the way people think about things, and like using a term like gender identity reifies this like this abstraction about that's like a self belief, and it makes it into something like seemingly like to use like a philosophy word like ontologically real, as opposed to like something that like we're socially constructing in relation to sex stereotypes. Like it gives it a kind of elevated status that it doesn't have.
Yes.
Unless we all like co-create it, right? Like, and agree that this is, so your point I think is a good one. And I think it gets at why education and why language are so important in this area, because again, gender affirming care is framed as like that's the term that everyone understands, and then like the connotations are so like,
yes,
affirming care, and then it's like, oh, you're an enemy of affirming care. Like what? It's like a thought terminating cliche almost, where it kind of it frames how people think about things. And then it's interesting because then you have like the Health and Human Services Department has now been using the term sex rejecting procedures. So you can kind of see the worldview clash here between gender affirming care and sex rejecting procedures, with these very different kind of like philosophical commitments that shape how we think about what's actually going on.
Yeah.
I think that, and some people have made this point, and until you address the educational component of this, which is like teaching like the gender-bred unicorn. And I think I don't see any problem with using the word gender as like the way I think a lot of people have often used it, which is like more like a sociological term for qualities that we associate with men and women. But it becomes different when gender becomes like a stand-in for sex, which is what a lot of activists want, is to like actually be like, it's kind of confusing, but from my understanding, they say basically like sex, even though most people would agree is like material and biological, they'll say sex isn't real. Gender is the real thing, and gender takes primacy over sex, even though gender is like the socially constructed thing. It's extremely confusing. But basically what they're trying to say is that this subjective aspect is more real and is actually our real sex over – it's a complete like metaphysical language game. It's like that's what I don't think the average person gets, is that we're playing we're playing metaphysical games basically.
Yep. So language matters. Language always matters, but it definitely matters in this space. And I think being careful about how we are unconsciously – giving it a quarter, you know, in our own lives and without even realizing it, we need to make sure that we are maintaining the realities of biology and you know, what is true scientifically about us as human beings. So, well, Joseph, I've loved this conversation with you. It's been good to get to know you a little bit more than I did before. Yes. So is there anything at all that before we wrap up here that is on your mind that you feel like you want to just share as a final thought to those that are listening or watching?
I'm just really curious to see what happens over the next several months I want to see if there's more like medical association dominoes to fall after.
Yes.
The American Society of Plastic Surgeons had a position statement in February coming out against surgeries, which then kind of forced, I would say, the American Medical Association to kind of piggyback off that claim. Yep. And I just want to see, I'm just really curious to see if that creates kind of like the permission structure, so to speak, for other medical associations to flip-flop. Because I've made this point before, but if you have this artificial consensus that's kind of been constructed by only a few associations, I think you could see a medical practice reversal kind of happen based on very similar logic, where just a couple of associations acknowledge the weak evidence base, and that you know, incentivizes other associations to follow suit. So I'm just curious to see what happens there.
Yeah. Well, you know, truth is, I've often, I love the phrase that truth is like a lion. You don't need to defend it. You just need to let it loose. And I think that's when truth starts to come out and leak out, when you've done all these carefully crafted ways of sort of containing it and keeping it in to prop up an ideology. And many times, again, people don't even know that they're doing that necessarily. It just is, it's in the water. It's what they
taught or trained. I think that's a good point too. I'm someone who generally, and maybe this is like my temperament and my academic background. Like I became a clinical psychologist. So I'm generally not, I don't think, like, I'm sure there are people in this area that act in bad faith, but I think that it's like a really complicated multi-causal issue that kind of like taps into a lot of different human motivations and psychological pressures. So I'm not one of those people that goes around like typically pointing the finger at a lot of these activists. I think that a lot of them really believe they're still dangerous because they're operating on false beliefs, but I don't think that they're like inherently like antagonistic or evil in every case.
I agree. I think there's some that know exactly what they're doing. And then there are so many others that have been convinced. So, well, Joseph, it's been so good to have you get some time with you and for you to be on our podcast. Really appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Love and Truth Network podcast. We look forward to seeing you in a future episode. Take care.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us for the Love and Truth Network podcast. We hope that the stories and insights shared have ignited in you a sense of God's powerful love for you and given you encouragement for your own journey toward relational and sexual wholeness. Remember, transformation is absolutely possible when rooted in grace, truth, and authentic biblical community. Subscribe today, share with a friend, share with your pastor, and we look forward to seeing you in our next Love and Truth Network podcast.